Do the veterans just want to start by saying what branch you were in the Vietnam War and how long you served?
I'll go first. This is Troy, and I was drafted in 1966 into the Army and served two tours in Vietnam, and that's kind of good enough. Go ahead, Tim. Jimmy.
Jimmy Gibbs. I was drafted in August of 64 and volunteered for a couple of different things and served for about 10 months in Vietnam on a B team as a radio operator. And that should be enough.
I'm Marion Parrish. I joined the Coast Guard in 1966 to stay out of Vietnam, and ended up volunteering to go later. Spent most of 1967 in and out of Vietnam, mostly TAD for your Navy and Coast Guard veterans, and ended up getting out of the Coast Guard in 1970.
Great. And Dr. Battle, do we know how many veterans are on the Kenai Peninsula?
I have a rough number. It's our staff provides me that intermittently. I don't have it in front of me, but my understanding is somewhere between 5,000 and 8,000 veterans. And again, I'd have to ask my staff to be able to provide more specific data on that.
And I think, Troy, you brought some data from the vet centers here. What do they say about numbers?
Yeah, the vet center says that according to census statistics from 2015, approximately 11% or 6,386 people living on the peninsula are veterans. That's out of a population of 58,000 people at that time on the peninsula.
And do we know how that percentage compares to either other parts of Alaska and to the lower 48? Dr. Ballard, is that something you have a sense of? Is this a big population percentage?
Yeah, I can say that we have the highest per capita population of veterans in the country. Unfortunately, we don't have a really good gauge of the absolute number of veterans because, quite frankly, not all of them sign up for the VA. And so I can tell you that the estimates for the entire state are somewhere between 70 and 90,000, of which about 36,000 have signed up to be enrolled in the VA, and about 21,000 are actually using our health services on a regular basis.
And let's talk more about the services that veterans might need. So when we're talking about transitioning from military to civilian life, what are some of the challenges that veterans face? Do you want to start with one of our veterans about challenges that you faced coming back from military to civilian life? Everyone, take that first.
It's not that different from the everyday challenges that everybody face. The places you go to meet those challenges is what's probably different. Everybody needs security. Well, that is the first issue. Everybody needs a roof over their head as part of that. And then when you get our age, health care becomes the predominant issue. I know that in the Vietnam era, those vets came back to a very, very different VA than we see today. Most of us had brief interaction with the VA and said, I'll never go there again. There are a lot of horror stories about how indifferent the VA was to Vietnam vets. This was before the establishment of the vet centers themselves. The vet centers are geared for reintegrating the combat vet back into society. The other vets that we have from other eras, the Gulf War, so forth, for example, face a different VA when they come out. However, they're still very reluctant to sign up. To sign up means you some sort of admission that you could use some help. And that is very tough. And a lot of people come to Alaska in the first place to get away. And signing up for the VA exposes you. And that's the general thought, the feeling of the veterans. And it's one issue I'd like to see go away. Get more veterans to trust the VA and to go ahead and register with them, because their services that they provide us are contingent upon how many they serve. Obviously, if there's a much bigger population out there that needs help, the VA could get some more resources. And that's my issue, my cause for now. I don't know if you guys have anything else.
You know, we definitely want to talk more about getting services at the VA and barriers to getting services and, like you said, stigma. But yeah, let's hear from the two of you about, you know, more about the challenges as well, of what you think the biggest challenges standing out to you of transitioning from military to civilian life when you get back and down the road.
Well, in my case, I think the biggest challenges was after I got back is learning that I shouldn't talk about Vietnam and not even let people know that I was a veteran. And after many years, I was here, you know, and I got a letter from the VA wanting me to come in and sign up for health care. And I thought, well, let's try this again, because, you know, after I came back from Vietnam, I got crossways with the VA and decided I wasn't going to have anything to do with them. So I went into the vet center, and they were very, very pleasant. It really helped me fill out the paperwork. And I've put in for my hearing, and I got a percentage for my hearing. And that put me on there in the VA system. And what I'm saying is the VA is now has a different attitude. And one of the big problems I have was accepting that I had have some problems and going in and working with the VA. And now, like I said, I've been working with them for a little over 2 years now. And it's very, very, what's the term I wanted to have? Uplifting, this help I'm getting. Like you go into the vet center in Salatna there, and they have a representative there from the American Legion, or even one of the other people there will help you with your paperwork. And of course, they want to see a DD-214. And if you don't have one, you can go in there and they will help you get a copy of your DD-214. Everything works around your DD-214, your discharge papers. Okay?
This is Marion. The other two gentlemen spoke about our transition back from Vietnam. It was a very, very different time. Troy mentioned that. And the public treated us very differently as veterans at the time. My perception of the VA was wrapped in with my perception of the government in general. And what I saw led to further perceptions about the VA. The VA hospitals at the time, in my perception, which is my reality, was that that's where you went to die. And being in my early 20s at the time, I didn't want anything to do with that. And I stayed away from it for 40 years. My wife, who is retired Army, retired from the military, insisted that I go and get on the Agent Orange registry. That's what brought me to the Vet Center in Soldotna to figure out how to do that. And at the time, they asked, do you have any issues? And I rattled off a couple of things that I considered just by fact of virtue of getting old, these things happened. But it turns out that they were service-connected, were service-connected, were documented service-connected. And that got me back into the system and back into, as Jimmy alluded to, getting some help with dealing with some of these issues. And that's good for now.
Yeah, and Troy wanted to say something.
I wanted to add something about the today's vet. I mean, getting out of the service in this time frame, the Gulf War vets and any other veteran getting out now. The Gulf War vets faced such a different situation in their combat than we did. We went over there knowing we were coming back in 1 year to that day. And that's when our tour ended, and we knew we were getting out of there then. The unit cohesiveness was a little more difficult, and because new guys are always coming and the old guys, experienced guys, were always leaving. Today's Army, Navy, Air Force, Marine, you're a unit, and you stay together as a unit, and you become their family, part of their family, and they become more important to the vet than maybe family back home, because these are the people who keep you alive and are so important to you. For us to get injured in Vietnam, it was we called it the million-dollar wound. It sent you back, probably got you out, depending upon the severity. But today's vets, if they get wounded, are forced to leave their family. Huge guilt sets in. Now they're not there doing their part to keep their buddies alive. Some resentment sets in sometimes, and the vets will be fixed up and be able to rejoin their unit, but it's not the same.
Dr. Ballard, I want to go to you. What stands out to you about what these men are saying? Are these sort of similar stories of challenges that you're hearing from other veterans? And like Troy was saying, are there differences you see between challenges of coming back from different wars?
Absolutely. And let me just back up by saying I'm a 32-year Air Force veteran myself. I just retired in 2016. So I faced a similar issue with the transition in that you enter the military, you put on the uniform, and all the services are handed to you. Everybody around you knows how the services work, particularly health care. All you got to do is basically walk into the clinic and you get seen. And then you transition out, and as the first gentleman, I think it was Troy, said, your primary interests are looking at, okay, where am I going to live next? What job am I going to have? Where am I going to put my kids in school? You don't really think about what the VA is going to provide for you in that transition point, but sooner or later you start thinking about that. And the difficulty is that there's no one that really provides you the cheat sheet, if you would, to get through the system. And so every single veteran is essentially navigating this on their own. And quite frankly, it's frustrating. It took a year for me to get my disability rating, and in that time, there's really no significant feedback opportunities from the VA to tell you how that's going. And so everything is kind of done in the blind, and I think that's very frustrating for all veterans. Now compound that for particularly the Vietnam veteran generation where, and I hear this frequently, many of them stayed away from government involvement for, 20, 30, 40 plus years, and then how trying to navigate the system when you have an acute medical issue just creates even more frustration and concern, because I'll be honest, in the 2 years that I've been the director here in Alaska, I see firsthand how slow our system is at responding to the needs of veterans. And I think that's something that we're working very hard to overcome. But this is something that's been inherent in our system for a long time. And it's a big bureaucracy. I'll be the first to admit it. I represent the Veterans Health Administration. There's a separate administration in the VA, the Veterans Benefits Administration. In order to get health care, you have to submit your information, your health information for disability claims. And every step of the way, there's not an easy navigated process. And so there have been great organizations out there, our Veterans Service Offices, some of our vet centers, all can help veterans navigate this, but it is a huge challenge. And quite frankly, I'm concerned that it's not getting a lot better. The Congress is our board of directors. We've got, you know, essentially 500 board members of the board who all can put in their perspective of how things should be handled. And what may be important for a veteran in Florida may not be important for a veteran in Alaska. But unfortunately, what I have to do is take the rules that are given to me and try to execute them as best as possible. And I think that the best thing I can do is be part of discussions like this. I have town halls on a quarterly basis throughout the state where I get a chance to talk with veterans firsthand. And we're trying to do what we can to improve our system. I think the best thing we can do at this point in time is we're hiring more staff to meet the needs of our veterans. And so we'll continue doing that part to provide excellent customer service. We know there's still problems that we're working on rectifying, but I think it is correct in saying that if we can have more veterans aware that the VA system now has improved significantly, and if we can get folks signing up, that may turn into even more resources for us to provide even better customer service and benefits.
Right. And there's a lot to unpack there, but, you know, you mentioned, and some of the men mentioned as well, that one of the, one of the reasons that people don't go to the VA is because the reputation precedes it, that they hear bad things about the VA. I don't know if one of our vets here want to speak to that about, if you've had personal experience of hearing things or how that sort of affected your ability or want to get help.
One glitch I see in the system right now is that when a vet walks in and doesn't understand the organization of the system, he desperately needs the help of somebody at the vet center or somebody, a veteran service officer. And those veteran service officers are the real heroes of the system as we see it. They are your advocate, and many of them are not paid. So there, if you want to feel safe and approach the VA, I would recommend going to the DAV, Legion, somebody who provides veteran service officers at no cost to the vet, and they would help you navigate your way into the system. I know there's a real stigma for the current vets coming out now to admit they might have a problem and to go seek help for it. That was highly discouraged when they were in the service. I was a pilot in Vietnam. I couldn't go in and state to the flight surgeon that I had any problems or I wouldn't be flying. And of course, that was all that mattered when you're 19 and someone's giving you a helicopter to fly. There's no way you want that to end. But I would say that we see these new vets coming in. They're much younger than us, but they're avoiding the VA. And I would say you need to be connected now, because when you get to our age, you will be needing them. And they can help you a great deal. So that's why I urge all vets, even if you don't think you're eligible for any or think you need any help, you might down the road. And it's absolutely no risk on your part to go in and register with them. And by registering with them, you get a more accurate census of the vets that are out there in the bush that aren't no one's aware of them. And I understand they want to stay that way, and I don't blame them. But I think it's safe now to come in out of the cold and at least let the VA know you're out there.
Would also help if they came in out of the cold with their numbers for us, too, because, like we said before, the VA needs the numbers in order to justify more help for all of us. Also, I wanted to add to what Troy was saying about the Vet Center in Soldotna has an American Legion service officer, and he's in there from the American Legion side, and he's your advocate when you're working with the VA. So, and he is not paid by the VA, but he's put in there by the American Legion. And if anybody wants to think about it, the American Legion has an awful lot of clout politically. And they actually need the numbers too. Like I just put my dues in for the American Legion here the other day so that they'd have the money to have the more clout with the VA and Congress, the, like Dr. Ballard said, the board of directors. Okay, your turn.
Nothing for Mary?
So, Dr. Ballard, you've talked about, you know, what the VA is doing to sort of educate people about what the VA has to offer. What are you finding are the best ways to sort of get people the help they need and sort of battle the stigma that these men are talking about for getting help and reaching out?
Well, Renee, I think that's a difficult question to answer. One of the dilemmas that we have is that we can't easily identify those veterans in need until they sign up. I hear all the time, well, the VA should have my information on file, and the honest truth is we don't. We have those veterans who have signed up for the VA. We can pull up their information, and we can provide services and support to them. But there's half the veterans in the state, at least half the veterans in the state, haven't signed up. And so when in situations like that, we rely on community collaboration. So at my town halls, I mention every time that we need to try to work together collaboratively to identify veterans at risk. We rely on a myriad of veteran-related organizations across the state to help sort of funnel veterans our way if and when they're in need or even before, so that we can get them signed up, so then when something does happen, we can immediately address their needs. Many people who've navigated the VA system realize that there is this sort of painfully slow orientation process from the time you decide you want to be in the VA to you actually have your benefits established and can get all the resources that you need. And we can't do anything to expedite that, but it would behoove all veterans to at least sign up so that that process is behind them once something happens that's needful. And so one of the things that we're doing this year is we're actually going to have a veteran summit where we're inviting Mr. Verdi Bowen, who's the director of the state military and veterans affairs office, and myself are coming together, inviting a myriad of veteran-centric organizations to help us sort of spread the word. We would like to identify a coalition of folks who, when we get a DD-214 sent to us of a separating veteran coming to Alaska, that we can have someone proactively go out and identify them, meet with them, tell them about what's going on in the VA so that they can make an educated decision about signing up as soon as possible. We think that that's something that the VA is sorely lacking. There's this expectation that the veterans will come to us and we'll provide the care. And as you've heard from some of the veterans already, that's not always the case. Many veterans don't realize that they should sign up, or they're hesitant to sign up because they may not want to participate in government at all. So we think it's important to bring these organizations together under, you know, one cause. Identifying veterans at risk and new veterans to the state and trying to provide them a line of communication to get them to sign up. And really, this is going to take community involvement. It's going to take outreach. If I'm sitting in my office every day, I'm not going to make any impacts on changing the environment for those veterans who might need our services to come in and get signed up.
And before we go forward, I think it's important to say, you know, there might be some confusion, and I think it might be helpful if you say a little bit more about what the VA does and what services are available and how it works, because not everybody might know.
Sure. So as I alluded to a little bit earlier, really a veteran has to sign up for the VA. And the way to do that, the easiest way, is to fill out a form 1010-EZ. It's now a single sheet of paper. I've heard many Vietnam veterans talk about the stacks of paper in the past. It's now one single page of paper. They need to identify, that they need to show verification that they are a veteran. So the best way to do that is to bring a DD-214. Once they get that paperwork and they get established in the system, there's usually a process where they need to submit health care information to establish a disability rating. And now, unfortunately, I don't make the rules with this, but the VA has created a very complex process to stratify veterans according to need. And so there's basically a myriad of categories of veterans, and based on the category of a veteran, that then rolls out what sort of benefits and health care support they get. And so the Veterans Benefits Administration establishes that disability rating. They coordinate the physical exams that are required to establish that rating. And they also execute the benefit that has to do with what may be a disability pension for anybody who may have an interest in buying a home, the home loan guarantee, the GI Bill-related services, and those sorts of things. And then once they establish a rating through the VBA, then that allows a veteran to have health care services through the VHA, which is the Veterans Health Administration. So my organization, I'm the director of the Veterans Health Administration for the state of Alaska. And so depending on the veteran's rating, we then can provide a myriad of services. Our foundational services are primary care and mental health support. All of our clinics have providers on hand to be able to provide those services. But there are also some other more significant services depending on where you're at in your life, specialty referral care, or even services supporting long-term care, or for those folks who have significant disabilities and may be homebound, we have home-based related care. We have care support models where folks can come into the home of a veteran and provide the services to help them with quality of life. And then as we get towards end of life, there's long-term care options that the VA provides for veterans. But all of that is predicated on their disability rating and how that qualifies them for services. And unfortunately, I'm personally frustrated as a veteran myself that the system is far too complex to be able to explain all the different categories in a very small period of time.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about a wide range of issues related to concerns facing veterans. You can be a part of the conversation by calling 235-7721 in the Homer area or toll-free at 1-800-979-5224. I want to go to, you mentioned, you know, frustrations with the VA. We've been hearing for years about concerns about, you know, problems at the VA. There was a big scandal in 2004 in which government officials allegedly falsified how long veterans were waiting to see doctors and also long wait times that resulted in the resignation of the Veteran Affairs Secretary at the time. Has the wait times become better since then? And this is. Let's start with Dr. Ballard on this, and then we'll go to our veterans.
Sure, I want to clarify that the problems of an individual facility within the VA doesn't mean that the entire system is problematic. And so, one of the concerns that came up is what you're referring to is Phoenix. Phoenix had a leadership team that decided that keeping care within their four walls to, you know, all their primary care, specialty care services as much as possible to optimize their budget was more important than optimizing the timeliness of veteran care. That doesn't mean that that was something that was happening at every facility, but every facility struggles with how best to handle their budget, and the decisions that were made at the Phoenix VA sort of blew up on them because, quite frankly, there were many veterans who were waiting months for specialty care when the promise is supposed to be within 30 days of the clinically indicated date that the primary care provider submits. And so I can tell you that at that time in Alaska, we didn't have those same problems. I wasn't here at the time. I came on board in 2016, but I can tell you from most of the veterans I spoke with, because we're just primary care and mental health and we end up purchasing most of our referral care, we had been doing this effectively for the past decade, so that the wait times for a veteran in Alaska were pretty good comparatively, and especially when you compare them to a typical Alaskan who may not have VA-related services. We know we have health resource limitations in our state. Many Alaskans wait 3 months, 6 months plus for a specialty care evaluation. And in our system, we frequently get veterans their specialty care appointments within 30 to 60 days. And the reason I say that is there is a processing time by our staff to process the referral, and then usually once we are able to reach the veteran with the authorization, we can get them in somewhere within 30 days. That's not always the case, but that's our goal in general is to do that. And I think we've been pretty successful over the last several months now that we finally have improved the number of staff providing this service for our veterans.
And I want to turn to our veterans now and talk about, you know, more about what your experiences of the VA has been, what both, you know, in terms of frustration and in terms of what it's been helpful for.
Okay. Well, I ran up against what I would call an organizational problem, and that, as I believe Dr. Ballard alluded to earlier, when you're in the service, you're used to everything being set up and knowing that it will be provided. If you need something, it's right there. When you come out and you go to the VA for medical care, and the VA finds out, I'll just use an example, I have diabetes, that would qualify me for a large disability from the VA. But the medical side does not communicate that to the benefits side. That's up to you. And the only way you can do that is through your VSO, file a claim. I would like to see a little bit more when the medical side discovers you have a disabling issue and might be eligible for care or for benefits, at least letting the vet know that. They're treating you medically, and that's what they care about, and that's the first thing they're going to deal with. And they're pretty busy doing that, so I can understand why right now it's not automatically being kicked over to the benefit side. But due to the way it's organized, they can't tell benefit side what your problem is. That's up to you. It's your information. And obviously, ethically, they can't give out your information for that reason. I have not found, I was outside for about 2 years and wandered into a vet center there, and that's another long story. But the way they were dealing with medical issues in Colorado, Oregon, where I was, showed they had a real problem with this outsourcing care. And that was a regional thing. That was Portland VA running things and not wanting to farm out to people who were 3 hours away on the other side of the Cascades. Whereas Alaska, if you had something they couldn't offer you without sending you to Anchorage, they'd find a provider locally. And for years, like Dr. Ballard said, we've been handling that. We don't have a problem outsourcing here. So in that case, we are ahead of the game. One thing I'd like to address organizationally is that currently the vet center in Kenai is a satellite center, their team leader, their boss, is in Anchorage. They send people down to Homer to treat vets on a regular basis, but it's a counselor comes down to Anchor Point twice a month and comes to Homer once a month and counsels veterans who don't want to travel clear up to Kenai to get that service. Likewise, the medical sends down doctor and nurse on a regular basis to the our hospital, which is giving them space for that. So they're working on getting the Homer vet some services provided they don't have to drive for. But I would like to see, if we can get the numbers, I'd like to find out how many more vets we need to have sign up to the system before Kenai can become a hub with their own manager and more staff, and we could get a satellite hub down, a satellite vet center down here in Homer.
And before we move on, Dr. Bell, do you want to respond to that and talk a little bit about, you know, where the services are at and, you know, the distance between people and the services and what that means?
Sure. So I think that was Troy that was talking. Let me just add on that, interestingly, the vet centers themselves in the state of Alaska are a separate entity from us. And so the leadership of the vet centers is outside of my jurisdiction. We have provided resources to support their leases, some of their HR related functions. But again, this is another sort of stovepiping of the VA. But to answer your question, we have a primary clinic in Kenai has two primary care providers, one prescribing mental health provider. We opened a satellite clinic in Homer, recognizing there was a need, and this was really Dr. Boone's initiative to address the need of veterans in Homer. And so he took it upon himself to drive down there 2 days a week to be able to provide support to those veterans. And it is true, if we could have a larger population of veterans in the Homer area signed up for VA healthcare services, that would drive us to provide a larger clinic presence there. We are pursuing a standalone facility. We do appreciate what South Penn has done for us to help us with spacing, but we do realize that we need a larger clinic, and we're in the process of pursuing that. We are also, now that we have a second provider full-time down at Kenai, Nancy Beam is her name, she's going to actually be starting to come down to Homer in the near future to provide a little bit more options for the veteran in regards to VA healthcare resources. So, again, we would like to expand our footprint in Homer, but it's really going to take more veterans signing up to justify it from a federal business perspective. But otherwise, right now, it's really essentially a two-day-a-week clinic with some mental health support in addition to that that's operating down in Homer.
And just to clarify, you said a standalone facility in Homer? That's something that you are looking into? Or what is the status of that? Do I have that right?
Yes, we submitted paperwork to our regional contracting office to open up a new facility or have established a facility outside of South Penn. South Peninsula has been very gracious hosts for us. The area that they provide us was adequate in the short term for Dr. Boone to be able to come down 2 days a week and see veterans, but we realize that there's more services that we need to provide. And so we've submitted the paperwork for that. Quite frankly, the VA process of doing contracts of this nature is slow, so we're probably looking at about a year down the road before we will have a relative solution and option for a standalone facility in Homer, but we have actively pursued that.
Yeah, and I think Troy has a question.
Well, I had to follow on that. We're trying to get vets to come in and sign up to help with this problem. I've asked the VA for data on that. how many vets are currently serviced in the vet center. We've got some data on that, but not numbers, real numbers. And how many more vets we need? What, in other words, what's the criteria? How many people do we have to find out there in the bush before that will justify a vet center structure like I described earlier?
A good question, Troy. And I, unfortunately, I don't know the information on the vet center piece. Their leadership has the criteria that would determine at what point they reach a saturation point to allow a standalone facility. I can tell you from the healthcare side, we would like to see 1,000 veterans in Homer or in that local area signed up. That is the ratio of a single full-time primary care provider. So that would justify full-time 5-day-a-week clinic operations is to have about 1,000 veterans impaneled for health care in Homer or in the surrounding area. I think right now we're somewhere, I think Dr. Boone's enrollment is somewhere close to 250, 300. I know that there's a number of other veterans that are being seen through our partners, whether it's the tribal clinic down there, whether it's other civilian clinics who take VA reimbursement. But that's sort of the magic number, if you would, to justify a full-time standalone operation for VA healthcare.
Dr. Ballard and the panel, this is Marion Parrish. I've been navigating this VA system currently for about 3 years or so, or attempting to navigate, and I still don't understand exactly how someone signs up for the medical end of it. Now, I've done everything through the vet centers. I would appeal to our Homer veterans and veterans that are within this radio broadcast vicinity to figure out how to sign up. I want to point out that Troy drives to Soldotna regularly every Thursday for a veterans combat group that we have. And I don't know how many other times I would like for him to address that possibly. And that is not a short distance over and over and over repeatedly. How do we get people to sign up? And I would appeal to the veterans again, if you don't sign up for yourself, sign up for the other people. You may not need these services now. Troy alluded earlier that you might, but you might not. But there's people who do need these services locally. And if we could get vet centers here and medical services here, it would benefit everyone in this area.
I absolutely agree, Marion. And so really the best way for a veteran to impanel in the VA healthcare system is to present to our Kenai clinic. They can sign up for an account through myhealthyvet.gov. That way they can sign up for or in panel for a health clinic through that modality. But most of the veterans contact our clinic either telephonically or in person to say, hey, I'd like to be impaneled into your clinic, and then we assign them a primary care provider. In the past, we've been at our capacity, so those folks who did come to our facility to sign up, we were referring them to the community. But like I said, we've been hiring more providers across our system, so there is now an opportunity for any veteran in the area to be impaneled with a VA healthcare provider for primary care. As I said, the best ways to do it are either present in person, call our clinic, sign up for My Healthy Vet. But again, that's predicated on establishing enrollment in the VA through the VBA and potentially likely including the disability rating assessment.
So we have about 10 minutes left, and Jimmy, I just wanted to ask if you had anything to add about challenges you've faced in the VA or what you hope to see going forward.
Jimmy Gibbs, the one of the problems that you always face in a bureaucracy working with civilians and like the doctors and the nurses and the PT people that give you physical therapy is communications. And you always run into that. And I've got a choice card, and it's got an 800 number on it. And I found that if I can get the medical people to file the paperwork and it's in the system, then I can call the VA up with that choice number, and those people will then expedite and make sure it gets in the, is in the system, and I get my appointments. But it's all about communications, like in everything. That's the reason we're here today, is trying to get communications with other veterans around. Okay?
And I might mention that today Jimmy and Marion drove down from Soldotna. So, yeah.
To support Troy.
to support the veterans in the area here and Troy.
Well, we're very glad to have you. Dr. Ballard, did you want to respond to that about communication or what Jimmy said?
I absolutely agree. When I first came on board here in our system, we had about 50 folks who were coordinating referrals for our Alaskan veterans. But the reality is that Alaskan veterans, their providers generate about 1,300 referrals a week. And so we saw a dire need to expand our staff in that regard. We're now close to 100 folks working referrals. And they are establishing relationships with the providers across the state. And we like that relationship. We don't think that a contractor from Arizona can have the same relationships with Alaskan providers that we do. And we're working very hard at bridging those gaps that Jimmy mentioned. There is a difficulty in getting medical information from a specialty care provider to our teams to be able to ensure that everybody is seeing the same information. So I can say that we do have some problems in communication coordination, and that, quite frankly, is why I go out on my town halls. In the span of 2 years, I've probably done somewhere close to 80 town halls across the state. And part of the reason is we only have about 650 staff to address health care needs of all the state's veterans, and it's just not enough. And if we don't go out in the community and talk to folks and have initiatives much like Troy is supporting here to try to get veterans involved, we're going to continue having these big gaps in how we provide service. And so we think it's a collaborative effort. It takes a village, so to speak, but we're trying to do our part to get more information out. But like I said, it's very difficult in the largest state in the country with such a small staff to be able to make a huge dent in the issues associated with communication.
With the time that we have left, let's talk a little bit about how national politics and legislation might affect services here. In June, President Donald Trump passed a $55 million Veteran Affairs Reform Bill. It was called the VA Mission Act, and it will change how payment works for private care, it'll expand the VA caregiver program, and review VA's aging infrastructure. Dr. Ballard, can you give us a sense of what changes might come from this here?
To be honest, it shouldn't change much at all. We think we have a great program that can provide veterans both primary and specialty care, and we're just hoping that the additional dollars allow us to provide even better timely care. Some of the key elements of the Mission Act is that, one, it's extending the CHOICE program for an additional year. There's $5.2 billion earmarked to maintain the CHOICE program, and that is the ability for the VA to refer veterans outside of the VA healthcare system if they either live further than 40 miles away from a facility or the wait time for a specialty care service is more than 30 days. In Alaska, all Alaskan veterans are eligible for CHOICE. It doesn't matter where you live. It doesn't matter what the timing is. And so, you know, expanding that program really means more of the same for us. I think the biggest thing is we were hoping that the Mission Act would allow our organization to essentially own the referral management process from start to finish, instead of having a contractor handle half the referrals and us handle the other half, and much of the confusion that's created when those systems don't talk to each other between contractor and VA. We thought we could do it better and be homegrown for the state, and the Mission Act is going to require another bid for proposals to see if a contractor will be available or will bid to replace the Tri-West contract that we have right now. So that's really the biggest thing that we're waiting for, is within about a year we should hear how that's going to work out. But in the meantime, the Mission Act really shouldn't change anything in regards to Alaskan veterans getting timely health care. And of course, it's expanding some of the other services, particularly the Caregiver Support Program. We think that's a great program. It was very limited to post-9/11veterans only, and now it's being expanded to many more.
And Troy, I saw you kind of shake your head during part of that about the contract. Do you want to say what you were thinking there?
I think Dr. Ballard covered it pretty good. And their emphasis is toward bridging that gap. That will be good. I would like to say one thing. I'd like to extend an invitation to any vet in the area to give me a call. And my number is 541-604-1285. I'd love to meet any other vets. If I can answer questions, fine. If you just want a beer, I'm buying. So that's all I got for that.
It looks like we just have a couple minutes left, but before we go, I do want to just, you know, briefly touch on concerns about privatization. I know the Mission Act has raised some concerns about privatization of the veteran affairs. Dr. Ballard, do you want to talk about, are those concerns valid, or what should people be concerned about when in terms of the Mission Act and possible privatization?
Yes, sure. I think that privatization is already sort of happened in Alaska, and that we don't have a hospital for the VA. And as we've discussed throughout this hour, we end up purchasing a majority of our specialty care services through our local and regional partners, whether it's DOD, tribal, or our civilian partners within the state. The emphasis of care for the VA is care in the local community. And really, privatization, in my opinion, is more and more of the care being handled by the civilian populace at the expense of the VA hospitals. And so in that light, it really won't impact us any differently. But I do think that there is a concern about privatization. I'll give you an example. I was in the Air Force for 32 years. When I first entered the Air Force, there were over 60 hospitals. Now there are 12. Many of those hospitals downsized because of BRAC or other policies, but the point is that all of that care that was provided in the hospital is now being provided in an outpatient setting by a military treatment facility, or if it does require an inpatient visit, those folks are being sent out to civilian hospitals. And so I see the potential with more and more care being purchased in the community that more VA hospitals can sort of die on the vine, if you would, because the specialty care services that drive inpatient care may start going more and more into the community. I don't know if that's a good or bad thing. All I'm concerned about is Alaska's perspective, and I think we're pretty insulated from that causing a significant problem to our organization.
And I think that's going to be the last word on this topic. A very interesting discussion. I want to thank all of you for joining me. Our three Vietnam vets, Troy Weiss, Marion Parrish, Jimmy Gibbs. Thank you for joining us.
And thank you for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
And thank you to Dr. Timothy Ballard, the director of the Alaska Veteran Affairs Healthcare System. Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. And I just, one final sentence. I will be down in Kenai for my next town hall on the 23rd of August at 5 p.m. And so I'd be happy to meet veterans down there at that time.
Great.
I would like to thank Dr. Ballard specifically. Thank you for what you're doing.
Thank you.
Ditto.
All right, that was the coffee table, and this is KBBI AM 890 Homer. Thanks for joining us.